KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 25th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music and Food Festival, June 23rd through June 25th at Lil's Albina Park in Portland. The Good in the Hood Music and Food Festival is the largest multicultural festival in the Pacific Northwest. This three-day music festival opens up with a community parade that travels through Northeast Portland and ends at Lil's Albina Park. The parade starts at 11 a.m. from King Elementary School on Saturday, June 24th, and ends at Lil's Albina Park, where there will be music, food, and resources while connecting people with experiences that strengthen unity in community. Again, that's the 25th Annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music and Food Festival, June 23rd through June 25th at Lil's Albina Park at North Flint Street and Russell Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. The mole is the beast that works underground, burrowing to discover and expose the foundations of this society we live in, a society of which the corporate media reveals only the surfaces. The mole digs deeper and eventually aims, like the song says, to root that mountain down, the mountain it is not afraid to describe as systematized exploitation, the mountain of capitalism. I'm Clayton Mortgage. I'll be hosting today's show with the help of Patsy Kullberg handling the technology. And on today's show, Bill Resnick will talk with Mark Weisbrot about the surprising showing by Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party in the UK's election last week. Then we'll turn to a local environmental issue with conversations Desiree Helligers had with people who spoke at the hearings in Vancouver about whether to build an oil-by-rail terminal there. Lori Mercier will be talking with Guardian journalist Jason Wilson about the alt-right and counter-protests in Portland and their significance. And I'll have a commentary on why it is that we are living in a society that requires so much violence to maintain. If you like what you hear and want to share it with your friends, you can find The Old Mole on the KBOO website by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can hear the whole show or any part of it, as well as past shows. Today's show will be up in a day or two. And now, here's Bill Resnick with his guest, Mark Weisbrot, to discuss the UK elections. Bill.
Thanks, Clayton. Hi, Mark. Welcome to KBOO.
Bill, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Mark Weisbrot, he's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He writes books, including Failed, What the Experts Got Wrong About the Global Economy. He co-authored with Dean Baker the book Social Security, The Phony Crisis. He produces lots of articles and op-eds that appear nearly everywhere. He also does frequent TV and radio appearances, especially likes to do independent listener-supported progressive stations like KBOO. And to top it off, he is also president of the organization Just Foreign Policy. Mark, the rise of Jeremy Corbyn and a British Labour Party, that is Corbyn's wing of it, is really amazing and inspiring, something like Bernie Sanders' story, but even less expected, and in fact on a far more radical and democratic, unapologetic democratic program. Mark, tell us about merry old England for the last many years and how Corbyn and his working class supporters have so shaken things up.
Well, I think a lot of it is that he was able to get his message out. You know, the in this last election, part of the problem is that UK has a much more powerful right-wing media than we have in the U.S. So it's true that the media here didn't give Bernie Sanders much attention in the race, especially as compared to Trump, ironically, because they didn't like him at all either. But in the UK, they really did a campaign of character assassination against Corbyn. And, of course, he had all these people in his party who were against him as well and trying to get rid of him. But he survived, and he was able to get his message out partly because of the Labor Manifesto, a document that they put out a couple months ago, which was, you know, a strong platform that was proposing expansion of the National Health Service, government-sponsored child care, expansion of labor rights, and things that people really wanted. And so that, I think, showed that it was the media's assassination of his character that was holding him down, not that the country wasn't ready for the kind of things that he wanted. And the other thing, of course, is that beginning in May, because it's official campaign period, according to law, they have to have TV coverage, has to give equal coverage to both sides or to the major parties. And so that helped him as well.
Yeah, he also, you know, he was sort of this rumpled guy from working class origins and a Labor Party, long Labor Party district in England, a backbencher, a critic. In the campaign, he began fumbling as he was always characterized, and then suddenly he became my understanding is, reading some of the speeches and debates that he had with the Conservative Party representatives, and he became a powerful stump speecher. He had these responses to conservative claims that just blew them out of the water. He was extremely sort of affable and successful and energetic. It was quite amazing, it seems to me, how people...
Well, I think he was always, pretty good. I've met him a couple times over the years, and I thought he was, I've seen him speak, and I thought he's very good. He's not the kind that, he doesn't make these really powerful, emotional speeches, but he's very clear, and he inspires people. In fact, this was, I guess, should put this first. I mean, this was also the product of a mass movement, like the Bernie campaign, and probably bigger, and young people especially, that revived the Labor Party in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I read the manifesto just this morning, actually. I found it sort of shockingly radical in a way that Bernie's, as critical and thoughtful and progressive as Bernie was in the U.S. context, it didn't mince any words. It stood for public goods. It was renationalizing the railroads that people want. It was rejuvenating and reversing all the cuts in the National Health Service. It talked about nationalizing the electricity distribution system and setting up cooperatives for energy supply that is challenging all the investor-owned utilities and re-regulating them. And more, in fact, I mean, it was quite amazing, protecting pensions, raising pensions, building public housing. I mean, it sounds impossible, of course, and almost absurd to think that the conservative neoliberal system would accept anything like that. And yet the people of England seemed to think that this was a lot of great ideas. There was no mincing words in that platform.
No, that's right. And obviously he wouldn't be able to get all these things. Although, the popular vote was pretty close. I think it was like 42 to 40
right
for the Tories. And if going forward, if the Tories are unable to form a stable government, and there are a number of people who think that that's a likely outcome, actually, in the next few months, if they have another election, I think he's got the Labour has a very good chance of winning. So this is, this is what the Labour Party used to be before the Thatcher era. And it was very similar in a lot of ways to the U.S., it's just that they were always more left. Say than the Democratic Party here, but you had the same transformation. You had New Labor, neoliberal, putting forth a neoliberal program.
Right, Clinton and Tony Blair, and
Iraq War was another thing. That's the one of the things that I emphasize, is that he was so honest about the whole war on terror. He said publicly after the Manchester attacks, he said that that the UK's interventions in other countries, and of course he was against all the wars, Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan,
But he did have a program for dealing with terrorism as a domestic criminal threat. It wasn't that he was going to be soft on it or somehow or excuse
it. He emphasized what people really need to know, that this is a result of U.S. and U.K. intervention in other countries. It's not, and that's, you know, something that most people are afraid to say, especially when they're running for office. So this was a very important part as well. And of course, there's millions of people there who know this. In fact, the majority of the country knows this, according to recent polls. But no one will say it. And you know, people appreciate the honesty and integrity. It was the same with Bernie, right? He's been saying the same thing for 30 years. Everybody knows he means it. Neither one of these guys has any whiff of corruption or, you know, self-interest even in what they're doing. And so it's a populist revolt that's going on all over the place. It's just some places where the left is too weak, you see for other reasons, you see this right-wing populism or this phony right-wing populism that you have in the case of Donald Trump is able to squeak by. But mostly, this is the direction, I think, that Europe is going to go, because, you know, even in France, Mélenchon, in the first round of the presidential election in France, you had a left candidate who came within 1.3 percentage points of making it into the second round.
No, with 20% of the vote. Let me do a station.
He had the same program as Jeremy, really.
Right. Let me do a station ID, and then we'll get back to the implications for the entire planet, but especially, I think, for Southern Europe, in fact. Let's get back to that. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Mark Weisbrot, who writes a lot of books and articles, and he's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We're talking about Jeremy Corbyn and the immense eruption in England against conservative. Actually, it's not just Brexit, the opposition to basically neoliberalism and a strong call for a government for the few and not the many, which is the that was Corbyn and the Labour Party's slogan during the election, for the few and not the many. Tell us about the implications for Europe and the world of Corbyn's ascent and popularity. And then we can get into the problem of governance, if he in fact ever, you mentioned it, it's not impossible that Corbyn will win a majority in the next year, and after that, maybe. In any event, there are real possibilities, but then what would happen? So first the implications, and then we'll talk about the problem of governing capitalism.
Well, the story, I mean, there is a common story in Europe. Obviously, the situation is really different in each country, and the Eurozone, the 19 countries that are in the Eurozone, have a special problem of not being able to control their most important economic policies. And so that's the toughest of all. I mean, you know, it's kind of ironic that UK was the first to vote to leave the European Union when they were less constrained than France or Italy or Spain or any of the countries in the Eurozone, because they have their own central bank and their own currency, and that has helped them. I mean, their unemployment is relatively low right now, like ours. On the other hand, there are plenty of other problems that people are angry about. You know, wages are not growing, productivity hasn't grown for practically a decade. And
but insecurity has enormously grown all over the world.
That's right. A lot of economic insecurity, and of course, a lot of people displaced by so-called globalization. And so you have those problems as well. But the big problem is, I think, the whole neoliberal set of policies. By that, I mean, you know, governments not willing to use the basic macroeconomic policies to pursue full employment, and in fact, in the Eurozone countries, going in the opposite direction and keeping unemployment twice the level it is here in the United States. So I think that's what everybody is facing, is how to deal with that. And in the UK, of course, the Labour Party put forward a straightforward program that prioritizes reducing unemployment. Mélenchon did the same thing in France. The Syriza party did something similar in Greece, but then they were kind of crushed by the European authorities. And because they wouldn't leave the euro, they're basically stuck right now in this 7-year depression. I mean, the economy is starting to recover a little right now, but all of the eurozone has a problem of mass unemployment that even with the slow kind of economic recovery that could happen, you won't get it. You're basically condemning a whole generation to either being jobless or, you know, a large part of them.
Right.
Or leaving the country.
Yeah, even though the neoliberal domination and the way, in fact, they're just squeezing working people to maintain this immense and growing financial apparatus, what happens if Corbyn or any, or Melenchon, or, I mean, we don't want to see a repeat of Syriza, but in fact, the capital has such power now. And it happened in England with Harold Wilson, and then the Brown government, Mitterrand in France. They made attempts to actually reflate the economy and create jobs, but and tax the wealthy to some extent. And capital, in fact, went on strike, basically, or flight, or made it impossible for them to govern, raised unemployment rates. And they became seen as, in fact, undermining even the weak economies that were then existing. How do you, in 30 seconds, Mark, deal with that question?
Well, I don't think you have the same thing. You would have the same thing today. I think that countries could. I mean, look at Brexit. Everybody, the IMF and all the newspapers, everybody said that they were going to have a terrible shock from Brexit, and it didn't happen. And, you know, that was leaving the EU, which is, you know, quite a big thing. And so, no, I don't think that any of these countries, if they wanted to change their policies, you know, you would have a shock at first, like you know, especially if you're leaving the euro, you have a new currency, and you would have a crisis, but then that wouldn't turn into this like 7-year depression that you have in Greece. It would recover, and then they'd be able to control their economic policy.
That's
okay.
Boy, I wish I could share that optimism. You know. Anyway, Mark, thanks so much for talking to us.
Sure, thank you.
Right. So long.
Bye bye.
And that's a little percussion from Weather Report, following Bill Resnick's conversation with Mark Weisbrot about the outcome of the British elections, here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Margridge. Next up, Desiree Helligers speaks with health professionals, organizers, and concerned community members who testified at Wendy's FSEC hearing in Vancouver about the anticipated health impacts of airborne emissions from proposed Tesoro Savage oil terminal. The segment begins with Dan Sears, conservation director for the Columbia Riverkeeper.
I think it's heard an earful already from doctors, from longshoremen, from local businesses, from students who are very, very concerned that the toxic air pollution from this project will add to the already unacceptable risk of dangerous oil trains coming through. Over the coming months, we will certainly be ratcheting up the visibility of this decision. Governor Inslee is viewed as a leader on climate. He has expressed grave concerns about oil trains and their safety, and so we are asking him to use common sense and to reject this permit. You know, what we're hearing today is some of the finer points of why diesel pollution from trains and why volatile organic compounds from this very volatile form of oil would harm the health of people in Vancouver. It would be unacceptable if that were the only issue, but we know there's more. We know that the oil trains themselves pose a completely unacceptable risk to those who live near the tracks. And we were just this last weekend in Mosier to commemorate the 1-year anniversary of the derailment and fire there. And so that hangs heavy over this process. I think everyone is aware in the wake of Mosier that it would be very counterintuitive hard to believe, even, that Governor Inslee could look at this set of facts and approve this project.
My name is Peter Cornelison. I'm a Hood River City Council member. Hood River has joined a number of communities up and down the gorge in opposing oil by rail transport. The one-year anniversary of the Mosier derailment was on Saturday, and it really brought home the fact that we're all at risk, both sides of the river, from these dangerous oil trains. The Oregonian did a front-page story on it several years ago, comparing the gorge air quality at certain times of the year to air in the L.A. Basin or the East Coast, air that's really not healthy to breathe. And this particular facility would add air pollution from diesel trains transporting the oil, plus 34 tons of volatile organic compounds, VOCs, to the local Vancouver air.
But you're definitely going to feel those impacts up in Hood River as well.
I think we will, yes. One concern that doesn't get talked about a whole lot is the potential for water pollution with the train tracks running right next to the Columbia. If a train derailed and some of the cars and oil fell into the Columbia, it could cause a major catastrophe, especially because the tar sand oil sinks. It doesn't float, so it's very difficult to remove. If it happened at one of the Columbia River dams, the Dalles Dam, the Bonneville Dam, it could destroy the fish ladders and close the dam for an undetermined amount of time. That concern actually came from the Army Corps of Engineers. The gorge communities get nothing out of these oil trains. Vancouver Energy is touting 100 to 300 jobs, but that pales in comparison to the new waterfront development that the City of Vancouver is proposing and going ahead with, which would be thousands of jobs.
My name is Melanie Plout. I'm an obstetrician, and I practiced in Vancouver for almost 30 years. I delivered babies at Southwest Washington Hospital. During my career, I was particularly interested in the problem of preterm birth. Babies who are born premature have a risk of lifetime disability and death. And so really this is the reason that an obstetrician gets up in the morning, is to try to prevent preterm birth. So when a recent article came out showing that fine particulate matter, otherwise known as PM2.5, increases the risk of preterm birth, I was naturally interested. We don't really have time to go into it in detail here today, but there were a couple of examples that I thought were interesting. For instance, during the Beijing Olympics, when they cut back on many of their local sources of pollution, reproductive adverse events went down. And there was a steel plant in Utah. When it shut down, preterm birth rates fell, and when it reopened, the rates went back up again. The implication for this project is that the oil trains and the marine vessels will be emitting more fine particulate matter and potentially causing an increased risk of preterm birth in the area around the facility and all up and down the Columbia Gorge where these trains will be running. So for that reason, I'm strongly opposed to this project.
So we've heard a lot today about, you know, this project bringing in living wage jobs. Who is actually going to bear the cost of the unequally born particulate matter and the medical issues associated with it?
Yeah, it's obviously all of us, but those issues tend to impact communities that have to live near facilities or rail lines, which is often low-income people. So there really is an unfair burden on those communities from these projects.
Dr. Patsy Kohlberg, who is also the Old Mole's engineer, just testified a few minutes ago. What was your former title before you retired?
Medical director and assistant health officer, Multnomah County Health Department. I think the main point that I was trying to make was that the environmental impact statement itself is a flawed document because they relied wholly on Tesoro's own data and modeling. And the few people that I've read who have tried to independently evaluate that data, they can't come up, for example, with the same results that DeSoro comes up with, but beyond that, there are just a whole host of issues that they simply have not taken into account. For example, the secondary production of formaldehyde in the ambient air. So there's a whole big problem with the EIS that people think is a perfect document, and it's far from that. And then the other issue I didn't get to talk about is that the facility will be located near a low-income community, which is Fruit Valley, and that has disproportionately larger share of kids, and there's also the county jail that is there, so there are going to be inmates who are involuntarily exposed, and the risks are not trivial when you talk particularly about respiratory disorders, but also about the carcinogens. No one, I don't think even DeSoro disputes that there are going to be some carcinogens that are going to be emitted into the air at this facility. And people don't understand there is no safe level of exposure to carcinogens. That is cumulative, and it simply cannot be said to be safe. The people who are going to profit from this is largely just the fossil fuel industry. I actually don't believe that workers in Vancouver are going to profit particularly, that they're going to be all these jobs. I think that this is going to create a lot of problem for the development that they're trying to do of their river side there, and I think
it's actually being built at the cost of far more reliable sources of regional jobs that don't have this environmental impact.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a lot of dispute over how many jobs are going to be won or lost, and the people who claim that there are going to be a lot of jobs, I think, take a very narrow view without looking at the total economy in the region and its impact.
We're also looking at a corporation that had a major explosion at their Anacortes facility in 2010, in which 7 workers died.
DeSoro is not a good corporate actor, unfortunately.
You just testified a couple minutes ago, and I'm wondering if you would mind just rereading your testimony.
Not at all. Sally Hart.
Thank you, Sally. And you live?
In Vancouver, yeah.
Thank you.
My son suffered immensely and died from a very rare bone cancer because his father, my ex-husband, was exposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam. Now, I know this isn't Agent Orange, but we have scientific proof that many of these chemicals are toxic to people. It's repugnant that you, if you approve this permit, we'll be gambling with our lives, your lives, and health, or lack of it, and the lives of our offspring. I figure it's a good litmus test. A good litmus test would be, if you think it's safe, would you be willing to live within 3 blocks of Tesoro's proposed oil terminal? Nobody answered. Let's stop pretending that these jobs are worth throwing one person into this sacrificial volcano that is the Tesoro oil terminal.
Vancouver activist Don Steinke spoke outside during a break in the hearing.
Don Orange and I, Anna Lona, went to a public hearing a year ago in Portland to demand that EPA clean up the Willamette River. Do we have to sue EPA to clean up the Willamette River?
Yes.
Well, now the question is, are we going to have to sue EPSEC and Southwest Clean Air Agency to clean up the air that Tesoro pollutes? The first thing that will happen is SWACA will say, we don't know who did it. And Tesoro will say, it wasn't us. It might have been the natural gas company. The natural gas company might say, it wasn't us. It was the Vancouver Steel place or the asphalt place. It takes them years to find out who even did it. And then they enter a memorandum of understanding that says, you can keep on doing this until you finally figure out what to do to solve it. And so in the meantime, people are suffering from this pollution for years and years. In the case of Hayden Island, it's been 18 years and still no action. So, Governor Inslee, you need to keep it in the ground, turn the trains around. Governor Inslee, don't make your clean air plan into a clean air sham. Thank you.
MC Cecile Gernaz from the Seattle office of the Sierra Club.
Yeah, we're all here today fighting for our ability to breathe. We're all here today fighting for a livable climate. Not just future generations, but my generation.
We're here.
This is happening now. And our not President Trump is trying to pull us out of the Paris Accord, which it took decades for the UN to get every country to sign on to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And just like that, the U.S. is out. Now, we are fortunate enough to live in a state where our governor immediately created a coalition of governors who will stick to the Paris Accords. But that commitment will not mean anything unless he acts on it. That's right. So when our climate is under attack, what do? All right. So when our climate is under attack, Governor Inslee?
This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And that's more drums from Weather Report, following up on the testimony given at the hearings in Vancouver about impact on air quality from the oil by rail terminal proposed for Vancouver. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and I have this commentary about why our social order requires so much state violence to keep it in place. Now, it might seem obvious that any social arrangement that must be maintained by force, by the constant threat and frequent use of violence, is a pathological one. Until one reflects that, after all, we currently and increasingly live in such a society. A family or a community that was held together in this way would call for some kind of intervention by social workers, perhaps. For you would suppose that there was something fundamentally unfair or unjust about the situation, some imbalance of benefits or power that could only be maintained by imposing the will of a minority upon a majority who are ill-served by the arrangement. However, you might instead imagine that the social arrangement was basically fair, but some of the people in it were evilly disposed, seeking always or often to take more than they had a right to. There are, of course, these two interpretations of the society we presently live in. Do we have millions of people in prison and immigration detention centers and so many police killings because of bad people opposing a just system, or because of an unjust system that screws up people's lives and souls? An article in The Guardian a few weeks ago suggests that it is the system that is at fault. For it details the rapid increase in private security forces around the world and ties this increase to rising economic inequality. In more than 40 countries, including the U.S. and the U.K., there are now more private security workers than public police officers, 232,000 private guards in the U.K. compared with 151,000 police. Quoting from the article, "Around the world, private security guards patrol shopping malls, elite gated communities, and some public streets. From El Salvador to Vietnam, private guards restrict access to walled elite residential enclaves that are cut off from the cities around them. In many cities, guards and metal detectors block entrances to luxury hotels that tower over the extreme poverty surrounding them. Guard dogs bark from behind the high walls and razor wire that have become ubiquitous in wealthy suburbs in South Africa, where in 2015 almost 500,000 security guards numbered twice the country's combined police and army personnel." End of quote. Well, all this increasing security is protection of the rich from the poor. It is necessary for maintaining the expanding inequality of property. The Guardian article cites Professor Deborah Avant, who points to the growing economic inequality as what lies behind all the security. She says, "You have a ton more money than everyone around you, so you want to protect it. Getting security from the private sector is the obvious way to do it," unquote. A U.S. magazine, Town and Country, wrote that fear of terrorism, a volatile political climate, and a pervasive sense that the wealth creation of a few has come at the expense of the many have made paranoia the norm, unquote. The U.S. company Pinkerton explains that its agents protect Fortune 100 CEOs and their workforces, famous entertainers, athletes, high net worth individuals, royal families, and diplomats, unquote. This impression that the legal forces of repression exist to maintain inequality is confirmed by the historical origins of police forces and prisons. The early accumulation of wealth that got capitalism up and running came from gold and silver from Mexico and South America, extracted from the earth by the ruthlessly coerced labor of natives and enslaved Africans. Needless to say, the violent coercion needed to keep human beings enslaved had to be highly organized. The same was true of the production of cotton and sugar in the southern U.S. and the Caribbean. Meanwhile, in Europe, the displacement of serfs and peasants from the land in England and France meant that the cities became crowded with people seeking work in industry. Thus were created what the French philosopher and historian Michel Foucault calls new forms of illegality, activities that were once not very important but are now intolerable in commercial and industrial, that is, capitalist ownership. Foucault writes, "The development of the ports, the appearance of great warehouses in which merchandise was stored, the organization of huge workshops with considerable quantities of raw materials imported from the colonies, and manufactured articles which belonged to the entrepreneurs and which were difficult to supervise, also necessitated a severe repression of illegality. The way in which wealth tended to be invested on a much larger scale than ever before in commodities and machines presupposed a systematic armed intolerance of illegality, especially where economic development was most intense." Unquote. In other words, it called for what Foucault calls the carceral state. Here in the U.S., the development of the modern police force also follows the capture of land, resources, goods, and labor by capital. Christian Williams, in his well-researched book, Our Enemies in Blue, summarizes that history as follows. "Control of the lower classes has been a function of policing at every point since the institution's birth and has served as one of the major determinants of its development. In the South, the police first approached their modern form after a long process of adaptation and experimentation in the official means of controlling the slave population. This mandate was determined both by the demands of white supremacy and by the economic needs of the plantation system, which was an integral part of the capitalist economy. The mechanisms developed to control slaves eventually expanded as slave patrols were charged additionally with regulating the behavior of free black people and that of poor white people, especially indentured servants. As modern capitalism took shape, the new industrial working class posed new challenges to the social order, and the police institution evolved to meet them. Like the slaves, these dangerous classes were marked as permanent objects for police control, and their lives became increasingly regulated by specially designed laws, selective enforcement, and heightened scrutiny." End of quote from Williams. Well, the greater the inequality in any set of social relations, the more coercion it takes not only to defend the haves and all their stuff from the have-nots, but more importantly, to protect the social order from revolution. So it follows that as inequality increases and people inevitably begin to contest their subordination to the rich and the powerful, the forces of coercion will grow in their penetration and intensity. What would it take to dispense with violence as an essential method of holding society together? It is not enough to say that we should reduce inequality to, say, the days when CEOs made only 20 times what the average worker made instead of what it is today, 276 times the average worker's wage. Nor is it enough to have Medicare and free higher education for all, though these are worth fighting for. The foundational inequality is in the control of our lives, of our labor, and the goods and services we need, and of the government, by the owners and executives of capital whose only interest is in accumulating ever more capital and power by whatever means possible. The power of capital versus the power of working people, that is the fundamental inequality and why we need to be actively and creatively thinking about how to abolish the power of capital. And next on The Old Mole, here is Lori Mercier with Guardian reporter Jason Wilson to review the alt-right demonstrations and counter-demonstrations here in Portland on June 3rd. Lori.
Thanks, Clayton. I'm here with Jason Wilson, who writes for The Guardian and many other publications, including Alternet, The Atlantic, and The Medium. He's based in Portland and has been studying the far right for a number of years. As Arun Gupta says of his work, if you want to know about the alt-right, militias, and the Christian right, Jason Wilson is one of the best reporters on right-wing extremism in the age of Trump. So welcome to KBOO, Jason.
Thanks so much, Laurie. I'm happy to be here.
You've been writing about the various alt-right protests across the country, from Boston to most recently, because I was following your Twitter reports in Seattle. But let's first talk about what happened in Portland last weekend. And KBOO has provided pretty extensive coverage of the few hundred who showed up in Terry Schrunk Plaza, of the alt-right, and the many more thousands of counter-protesters in surrounding blocks. And you wrote a recent piece in The Guardian about how the Department of Homeland Security police enlisted the help of an alt-right protester from the American Freedom Keepers to arrest an anti-fascist demonstrator. So what are you finding to be the relationship between the police and the alt-right?
So I did kind of ask some questions of the various participants in that arrest of whether there was a kind of concrete link or communication beforehand, and I didn't find anything like that. But it's still striking, I think, that a DHS officer would ask a partisan protester for assistance, you know, in arresting another protester. And you know, as I said in the report, you know, quoting ACLU sources, I mean, you know, there's a question there about structural bias and why police officers feel more comfortable with one side of this ongoing conflict that's kind of national than they do with the other side. And a question about what would happen if someone from the counter-protest had offered to help a DHS officer arrest someone from the alt-right protest. I mean, I can't imagine what would happen then. So there's a broader question there, I think, about the way in which who police feel comfortable with and who they feel comfortable enlisting help from. And that should be a concern, I think.
Now, in the Portland context, did you observe different treatment of the alt-right and anti-fascist protesters?
Well, I mean, on the whole, throughout the day, I wouldn't say that there was anything, you know, too dramatic, although obviously most of the arrests came from the counter-protest. So that's something striking. But I think that particular incident illustrates something in terms of, you know, where the sympathies or it raises questions about where the sympathies of DHS officers lie. And I think it's appropriate that the U.S. attorneys open up an investigation on that, and hopefully we'll get to the bottom of that.
Now, just from observing some of these protests of the alt-right around the country and just most recently in Seattle, what do you find are the larger aims, or what explains this kind of profusion of protest by the alt-right around the country, and what are the linkages?
The rallying cry really is this idea of free speech. You know, all of these rallies will be held in the name of free speech, and they claim that their free speech is threatened by, you know, particularly anti-fascist Antifa groups who they really have adopted as a kind of enemy. The striking thing is that rallying cry has brought together different segments of the far right and even what we might be encouraged to think of as mainstream conservatives. So, you know, in Schrunk Plaza last week, we had people from the Patriot Movement, you know, inland militia type groups, standing side by side with, you know, the alt-right proper, which has arisen from internet subcultures and the like. and also open white supremacist groups like Identity Europa, and, you know, and then mainstream Republicans. Multnomah County chair of the GOP, James Buchel, you know, spoke to the rally and appealed to young people at the rally to get involved with the Republican Party. And to me, that's striking. That's new. That's quite striking group of different interests and different segments of the right coming together and standing around together and having conversations and finding common ground and who knows, maybe finding common cause. And that's, yeah, that's something we need to think about, I think.
Now, the fact that these protesters have launched these campaigns in places, you know, what we think of as more liberal, progressive cities like Seattle, Boston, Portland. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, I think there's definitely, you know, one way of explaining that is that they see these places as enemy territory, and you know, if they can have organizational victories in enemy territory, that's quite meaningful to them, and they see that as having struck a blow against a body of opinion that's opposed to them and opposed to the president, and you know, supporting President Trump is something that's also a major current in these rallies. With that said, I think a city like Portland has long been a kind of target of far-right organizing. I wrote an article the week before last just detailing the way in which Oregon and the Pacific Northwest were set up as kind of exclusive, you know, white territories, and there were laws to keep people of color out. And across the late 20th century and now, you know, we're seeing a repeat of that now, you know, extremist groups, white supremacist groups targeted Portland because they saw it as a place where they would encounter perhaps less resistance than in cities with larger communities of color. You know, and Portlanders have resisted that in the past and they're resisting it now, but there's no doubt that that's something that plays into the far right's thinking.
I was just wondering if there was any kind of strategy that you had observed among the far right to try to just elicit more media attention, and regardless of where they might be mounting their protests, perhaps in these whiter cities like Portland, they suspect there won't be so much resistance and therefore gaining that much more media attention, or on the other hand, generating some kinds of conflicts and street battles that might also generate the kind of publicity that they're yearning for.
I think, yeah, zooming out beyond Portland and looking at the way that in general they have staged these kind of incursions into the heart of liberal cities, I think that they are attracted to the prospect of conflict. They are attracted to the spectacle of conflict. And they're looking for these moments, I think, where they're able to occupy space, successfully occupy space in cities seen as liberal, and to, you know, get their messages out in the heart of those cities. And, you know, even when they're outnumbered, as they were in Portland last week, I think that a lot of the time, if they can just occupy that space for a period of time, they see that as a kind of victory and as an opportunity to rally their supporters.
And perhaps emboldened by at least tacit support by the police.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that incident that I reported on, where allegedly a DHS officer asked for assistance from someone who was providing private security, who was a member of a newly formed and apparently Portland-based patriot movement, militia-type group. I mean, you know, I think that those incidents are certainly, you know, if that turns out to be what's happened, those kind of incidents are certainly emboldening for those people and endorse the idea that they can bring their own private security to these events and that will be well received. So I think that we're in territory there that people will find disturbing, I think.
You have written that when you discuss right-wing movements and ideologies, liberals often dismiss what you've said on the basis that we're not in danger of a fascist takeover. The brown shirts have not yet arrived in the White House. That's maybe we could argue with. But how do these movements impact societies more broadly, whether in the U.S., and you followed the right wing in Australia as well, even in France? How does this affect the goals of the left and even the conversations and dialogue that takes place about various issues?
I think perhaps that recent events, you know, from last year onwards, may have given some of the people who used to say those kinds of things to me pause, you know. And I think there is ample evidence of, you know, fairly direct connections between far-right movements and certain people on Donald Trump's staff. There is a kind of presence now in the White House that, you know, may not literally be brown shirts, may not literally be fascist totalitarian government, but, you know, that they've opened up a political space where certain ideas, certain policy moves become possible, become thinkable. Mass deportations, building a wall on the southern border. You know, and I think in general that demonstrates, you know, what I and others, you know, who I've been influenced by have argued in the past, that as long as these movements are out there in public making their arguments, as long as they're recruiting people, as long as they're being indulged or even appealed to by mainstream conservatives, it has a tendency to drag the whole conversation right. It has a tendency to make the kind of policies that they support and promote thinkable, to make them a matter of mainstream debate. Yeah, so you don't literally need a fascist takeover in order for far-right ideas to become part of, you know, the currency of everyday politics. And I've seen that in Australia, in particularly with issues like refugee policy over a number of decades.
So that racism becomes more normalized. It's not unusual to find that kind of racist language, racist behavior.
Yeah. I mean, to use the example of Australia, and I think, you know, we can find examples here too, but an idea that the compulsory detention of refugees, you know, in offshore islands and never letting them into the country, that's gone from a far-right position to a consensus position that centre-left and centre-right parties both effectively support. That's the way it happens, you know, because mainstream politicians, you know, look for ideas that are popular, or look for ideas that can attract a certain segment of the electorate, look for ideas that can mobilise people, and, you know, become kind of, over time, become supportive of those ideas. So I've seen that happen in Australia, and I think, you know, we're seeing similar things happening here now as well.
Now, you wrote in December that the upsurge of hate crimes around the country should certainly be monitored and resisted. But you thought then that it seemed like these fascists or alt-right groups had maybe peaked in terms of their political clout. But you were more concerned then about the Christian rights adherents, who include many more tens of millions of people in this country. And so would you say that's still the bigger threat to progressive ideas and values?
Well, first, I would probably have to say that I was wrong about, I think, that the far-right activism having peaked. I mean, the striking thing to me is that the gentleman who assisted the DHS officer was part of a newly formed militia group, you know, who only apparently became active online, you know, in May this year. You know, and I think that movement is emboldened and is still trying to do stuff, and that's pretty clear. The Christian right, I felt the need to write about them because I feel like they've been forgotten in this whole discussion. And there are really strong arguments to say that, electorally speaking, they were the most crucial component of Donald Trump's coalition, despite the fact that he's as godless and immoral in their terms a candidate as we've seen in this country in recent history. So, you know, I think that the Christian right is still underestimated. I think that they're capable of mobilizing millions of voters and delivering electoral outcomes. And I think that moves that Donald Trump made early in his administration have shown that he believes that he needs to retain the support of that group to deliver political outcomes for them, such as his moves to repeal the Johnson Amendments, you know, which prevent non-profit groups like churches from outright political advocacy. He clearly believes that he owes those people, and, you know, he's going to try and deliver political outcomes for them, and I imagine that they're going to come out and vote for him again in 2020. So, yeah.
Well, Jason Wilson, thanks so much for coming into KBOO today, and I urge listeners to follow Jason Wilson on Twitter and in The Guardian and other places. And also want to point out your weekly Guardian column, Burst Your Bubble, which tries to understand the right-wing conservative media and its stars. It's very helpful for educating all of us on who's who in the conservative right-wing and growing militia and alt-right movements. Thanks again, Jason.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks, Lori and Jason, for that really enlightening discussion. And that's going to wrap up the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. Many thanks to Bill Resnick and Mark Weisbrot for their discussion of last week's elections in the UK, to Desiree Hellegers for her interviews about the proposed oil terminal in Vancouver, and again to Lori Mercier and Jason Wilson for their discussion of the alt-right demonstrations and counter-demonstrations. Remember, you can always find the Old Mole Show on the KBOO website. Just go to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show will be there in a day or two. And join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg. And thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.